again. Welcome to the Dishcast. Thank you for subscribing. If you haven't, for some reason, subscribed yet and want to listen to all of this conversation, which will peter out if you haven't paid anything, about an hour in, then please subscribe. It really supports us. We're now edging, if that we can use that word, 21,000 or so paid subscribers and 160,000. Oh, 160,000 in total. Okay, 140,000 non-paying. So please help us. The kind of guests we're having, we're coming up, pretty stellar. We have Eli Lake is going to come on, my old friend and passionate neocon and Israel supporter, Eli Lake. So we'll have a lovely conversation next week about Gaza, etc. Adam Moss, my old editor, is coming on to talk about the artistic process. Johan Hari, my old friend, on Ozempic. George Will on conservatism. The great and powerful Nellie Bowles on the woke revolution. Bill Maher is coming on, and we'll have a huge fun conversation with him. And Van Jones, who's going to be a Substacker. Another one joins the throng. But this week, we're going to cover a topic that's actually really close to my heart, obviously. It's called Coming Out Republican, History of the Gay Right. And Neil J. Young is the author. He's a writer and historian, and he used to be a contributing columnist at The Week, and he now co-hosts the history podcast, Past Present. And his first book was We Gather Together, The Religious Right and the Problem of Interfaith Politics. And this is his brand new one. It took him 4 years to write. I was one of the people he interviewed, just a heads up, one of the many people he interviewed. And reading this book in the last half of the book is like loads of people I know and events I remember and participated in. So it's kind of fascinating to see someone else come and write a history of something that you were very much a part of. So Neil Young, thank you very much for coming. Welcome to the Dishcast.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So I thought we would, just to start with, talk about some of the early figures in the gay rights movement who were not, I mean, I know this is going to come as news to everyone, but they weren't trans women of color whom we're otherwise taught began this movement, created it, and did everything for it, and just to the benefit of white men. But actually, it turns out, and this book shows, that some white men, despite being white and male, were actually in favor of gay equality. But first of all, tell me where you grew up and who your parents were.
I was born in Orlando, Florida. I grew up in the suburbs of Central Florida in the 1980s and early 90s. My parents were, had one younger sister. My dad was a lawyer. My mom was a former high school teacher who, once I came along, was a stay-at-home mom. They were from other parts of the South. My mom grew up in a small town in Mississippi. My dad was from Memphis. They had both moved to Orlando in the late 60s, early 70s for job opportunities and met at First Baptist Orlando in the singles department and got married a couple of years later. And yeah, we had a pretty, I don't know, traditional life centered around church, school, and community. A very, very happy childhood for which I am very grateful.
That's a lovely thing to hear. Where did you go to college then eventually?
I studied undergrad at Duke University. I majored in history and English and moved to New York City afterwards and hung out there for a couple of years with my friends from college and then ended up applying to graduate school and got to stay in New York and did a PhD at Columbia under the direction of Alan Brinkley and ended up living in New York City for almost 20 years.
Wow. Alan Brinkley, just a wonderful person to work under. I had the privilege of getting a little of him at Harvard back in the 80s. And you were presumably, you were gay. You were figuring out that you were gay. When did that happen? And how did the atmosphere of the 80s and 90s affect that with you?
I was someone who always knew I was gay. I mean, obviously, I didn't have a word for that at a very young age. But, you know, I knew really all along. And I always say that one of the things that helped me know when I was very young that I was different was I used to love the Dukes of Hazzard, and I would watch it every afternoon, you know, on the reruns on TV. And I remember knowing that I was supposed to sort of feel a certain way when Daisy Duke came on the TV. Like, I understood in her cutoffs and her, you know, sexy look that she was the one that I was supposed to be captivated by. And instead, I really liked it when Beau and Luke came on the screen. And I just knew that that was something different. And obviously, I didn't have a word for it. It wasn't sexual. It was just about a sort of interest and an attention. But I knew it marked me as different. And so I sort of always knew that. Obviously, I'm growing up in a fairly conservative community, certainly conservative family, as a Southern Baptist in the 80s in Central Florida. And so, you know, for me, it was something that was, you hid in a way that I don't think was all that unusual for anyone, no matter where they were growing up in the 1980s and 90s. And also just sort of always knew that I would eventually go off to college and be an adult and live my life. And that's what I did. And I'm compressing a lot of history here, obviously, but I think that's the sort of short arc of it all.
Which of the two guys in the Dukes of Hazzard did you have a real crush on? Because I had a similar thing with Starsky and Hutch.
And okay.
I was Team Starsky all the way. The blonde thing didn't really do anything for me. Was there any preference between the two?
I was probably a fan of Beau. I also really enjoyed Chips. Do you remember that show?
Oh, yeah, with Eric Estrada.
Yes. So, you know,
Were you with the blonde or the Latino?
You know, I just enjoyed attractive men on television, I think.
You're not drawn to these. Very divisive ideological disputes. So anyway, so this book, you did it after a book you wrote about the religious right. Mm-hmm. Where did the idea of doing this book come from?
Well, it's interesting. I've actually had this idea in mind for more than 20 years. I grew up in a Republican family. You know, I've always been interested in politics. My family wasn't political at all, not very conservative, but, you know, we were a family that read deeply, paid attention to the news. I was fascinated by history from an early age. All of that shaped my interest in my first project on the history of the religious right. But as I was saying, I before I went to graduate school, right after college, I moved to New York City, and I'd had sort of that experience. You know, you go to college, you come out, you maybe shift your politics a little bit. That's what I saw reflected in so many people around me, and didn't think all that much about it. And I moved to New York and was meeting, you know, guys who were bankers and who were consultants and, you know, who described themselves as, who called themselves Republicans, or a lot of them, you know, described themselves as libertarians. And I just found that interesting. I mean, these are, you know, the early years of the George W. Bush administration. And one particular guy told me he was a member of an organization called Log Cabin Republicans, which I hadn't heard about at the time. But this was also the years in which this organization was really becoming nationally prominent and was certainly starting to be in the news a lot. So I began to hear a good bit about it. And I just sort of filed it away as an interesting thing, and then went to graduate school, embarked on a career as a historian of modern conservatism. And imagine this is my second book project in academia. And I thought it would be really interesting as a historian of conservatism who wrote this first project about the history of the religious right to then sort of look at this other wing of the Republican Party and to think about what this means for the broader terrain of conservatism in the second half of the 20th century to come from this very different vantage point of gay Republicans. I ended up not staying in academia, left it more than a decade ago to do full-time freelance writing and a different career. And so I sort of just put this off as an idea. I mean, it just sort of went to the back of my mind. But it was always there. And then two events in 2019 caused it to come to the forefront of my mind and to really want to do this project now. The first was Pete Buttigieg running for the presidency. Obviously not a gay Republican, but, you know, at the time he was running as a centrist Democrat. He was getting really attacked from the left, particularly from the LGBTQ left. And that, first of all, really upset me. I thought, here's this historic breakthrough, this historically significant moment. And he is just getting pilloried for the way he looks, the way he acts, the way he shows up in the world, which felt really similar to how I, you know, look and act. And I ended up writing a couple of columns about that at the time, but it made me start thinking, you know, we need a broader history, a broader narrative here of LGBTQ persons that isn't just a history of political progressives, that isn't just a story about liberal actors, that really speaks to a much broader and diverse spectrum of politics that we know to be true. And so that was partly it. And the other thing was, in 2019, in anticipation of the 2020 election, both the Trump campaign team and the Republican National Committee did unprecedented outreach to LGBTQ voters. Now, the Trump campaign team stuff built on stuff that had happened in the 2016 election, but the stuff the RNC did, that was the first time ever. They actually appointed, you know, a person within the RNC to serve as outreach director to LGBTQ voters. I view that somewhat cynically in my book, but nevertheless, I understood that this is historically significant. This is really a big deal. And those two events really made me want to dive into this history, to really grapple with something that almost no one has written about, certainly not at this length, and to really understand and appreciate what this history is, how it's changed over time, and what it might mean for our current moment.
I must say, I'm grateful for this book, because for all the reasons that you say, the average person would think gay Republicans, that maybe there are three of them in the country, right, and all insane and hateful bigots. And that's what the mass media will tell you. I mean, that's what every single, or they will treat gay Republicans as if they're some kind of weird alien creature from a foreign country you have to kind of talk about with a pair of tongs, as it were. But this actually helps set the broad movement in context. In other words, it's not just a post-1969 trans women of color movement, which is what we're currently being told, that gay rights were created by trans women of color who didn't actually attend Stonewall, weren't even trans, but that is the current thing. And to have any book that actually takes you back, way back to the first decades of the 20th century, and to see that, in fact, the movement for gay rights spread across a variety of different politics. It came from libertarians, it came from conservatives, it came from leftists, it came from communists, it came from liberals. It was a mix. Tell me, just before we start, like, Trump did quite well in 2020, didn't he, with gay men and lesbians? I won't use the LGBTQ thing because all sorts of reasons, but the gay men and lesbians did. And they, what was it, like almost 30%, 28%?
28% is what the polls say. You know, there's all sorts of questioning about just polling in general in the 2020 election, given COVID and all the rest. But the numbers that a lot of polling indicated were right around 28%, which, even if that weren't the case, we do know in 2016, he only got 14%. So whatever it was, it had to be a significant number above 14%. And so that's really significant and striking and important, that over those 4 years, given the presidency, given the Trump administration and the way he conducted himself as president, that this was a demographic that we know he grew his vote within. And whatever that actual number
along with every minority group, I might
add. That's right. That's right.
So and here's one thing I don't think you quite dealt with in the book, which is why. Like, certainly if you look at African Americans, it's not one in three. If it were one in three, we'd have a Republican lock on the presidency if that were African Americans. People regard gay people, especially in the current context of trans queer people, as obviously very left wing. Why would a third of these trans queer people are voting for Donald Trump, who's not just a Republican, but a really authoritarian Republican, someone that I have consistently opposed as a conservative, as a gay conservative. Where does that come from? How do you explain that broad phenomenon of the remarkable conservatism of many gay men and women?
Yeah, so I think here's where history is really helpful, right? So the question actually shouldn't be why, or I'm going to change the question a little bit to say that the aberration is not 28% voting for Trump in 2020, but actually only the 14% who did in 2016. That is the number that sticks out from the historical norm. We have polling that goes back to the 1992 presidential election. That's when they started polling the gay vote. Actually, we have polls from the 1980s that were happening in state and local races, which I can speak about. But the first national vote is 1992. Actually, George H.W. Bush that year only gets 14%. And that is a historical low that was matched by Trump in 2016. But in all the other presidential elections since then, LGBTQ voters give the Republican presidential candidate between a quarter and a third of their vote. That is a consistent historical phenomenon. And so 2016 is the aberration, not 2020.
Now, to you and me, that doesn't seem that shocking, it seems to be, but precisely because we've been out as gay men. We've been out in the gay world. We've met lots of gay men, and we can see that they're a variety of and gay and lesbians too. That's not, and yet our groups, the people representing us, are all on the far left of the left at this point. So there is this, and most of the spokespeople for the current trans queer movement are also on the left of the left. I just think the other thing I think is that gay people are born randomly, right? So we're, each generation, we don't concentrate like other minorities in particular geographic areas and then develop a generational identity. So we're born anew every generation. And of course, half of us are going to be red state gays. We're going to be born into conservative families. And so inevitably, there is always this, because of the randomness of homosexuality, and we don't quite understand why, but it does seem to exist everywhere. Each generation maintains political diversity in some kind of way.
Right. Yeah. And can I just add a little bit more data that I think contextualizes that even more? I mean, I'm a historian here, so it's weird for me to be saying, let's bring more data into this. But I think this is useful to speak to that. So, you know, over the last decade or so, polling shows 15% of LGBTQ people are registered with the Republican Party among a population of about 9 million LGBTQ registered voters. So like 1.35 million are registered Republican. And I think that sort of small number speaks to what you were just talking about with the sort of lack of a public representation or a lack of even a public idea that gay and lesbian persons would belong to the Republican Party. But what we're talking about really a lot about this is how they vote. And when it comes to registration, only 50% are registered with the Democratic Party. So anywhere between 35 and some polls show as high as 43% are independents. And again, historically, we know that especially for LGBTQ independents, maybe even more than heterosexual independents, this vote is a vote that in any given election is really up for grabs for them. And we see that in the constant shifting of these numbers, and especially how it plays out. I think LGBTQ voters I wish we had real concrete data to show us this, but I'm going to speculate that the average LGBTQ voter splits their ticket a lot more than the average heterosexual American voter does.
I'm registered as an independent. I've actually voted Democrat for the last God knows how many elections because I haven't felt comfortable with Republicans at all on a whole variety of issues. But yeah, I totally get that. Even if they're not officially Republican, there would be sort of hardcore red staters, really. A lot of them are kind of open-minded. They have a mixture of views. You certainly can't predict someone's views on foreign policy or taxation on the basis of their sexual orientation. But I think that's kind of a crucial fact about the gay world that a lot of non-gays, and indeed some of the more aggressive advocates for gay rights, kind of slight. It's more diverse politically than many other minority groups. And so when you look at the history, you also see diverse characters from right and left. I'm not dismissing the role that left-wing people had in this movement, but I am saying, and the book kind of documents in this rather very well-researched way, the variety of people who contributed to this movement. And I thought we'd go through a few of them just as individuals, because I think their biographies are also interesting. You come with this rather remarkably named, I've never heard of this guy before, and so that's on me, and I'm grateful to learn about him. A man called Dore Legg. Can you tell me about him a little bit?
Yeah, can I give you his full name? William Lambert Dore Legg. He went by Dore Legg, D-O-R-R Legg. He was an absolutely fascinating character for me. I'd never heard about him before either. And to delve into his history and to know how important he was, and he is fairly well represented, actually, in the historiography of the LGBTQ historiography. But And this, I think, speaks to what you were just sort of saying about the lack of representation and the sort of lack of variety that we see in a lot of this history. He would be mentioned in these histories of homophile organizations because he was so important to them. But there would be this like little parenthetical aside, like, oh, he was a Republican, or, you know, there'd be one sentence that said, you know, and eventually in the 1970s, he helped found the first gay Republican organization in Los Angeles. And, you know, these parentheticals and these asides are sort of way of like basically acknowledging that part of him, but not at all grappling with what that meant for actually the history that they, those historians were writing about. And so I wanted to take that parenthetical and make it a whole chapter.
Right.
What does it mean that this guy is a conservative, don't tread on me, Midwestern Republican who moves to California in the 1940s and helps, he's not the founder of, but he's one of the earliest members of the Mattachine Society. So he comes from this fairly well-off family in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They are dyed-in-the-wool conservative, or excuse me, Republicans. His family actually traced their political history back to the origin of the party around Abraham Lincoln, and they were very proud of that. And they thought, with good reason to do so, that especially in the early 20th century, they saw the Democratic Party as, you know, mob bosses in the Northeast and racist in the South. And they believed in liberty and equality and freedom. They really had a sort of libertarian strain to them. And his father was a small business owner, and he grew his son through his own business. And so Doorleg went off and became actually a landscape architect, lived in New York City for a while, eventually moved to Los Angeles, in part because he'd moved home to Michigan when his father was dying to take care of him. And Doorleg liked to date Black men, and being out and about with Black men in Detroit in the 1930s easily raised the eyebrows of police, of the vice squad. And he was arrested simply for walking down the street with some Black men. And he thought, what in the world? You know, this is just, isn't this supposed to be the land of liberty and freedom? And so he decided to move to California, because in his mind, that was a place where he could do what he wanted in a way that a lot of Americans believed. You know, the American West was the land of opportunity, freedom, and leave me alone. I can do my own thing. There's going to be no prying eyes out here. And he moved out to Los Angeles, and he joined up early with the Mattachine Society. Now, the Mattachine Society had all sorts of people involved in it, but it had like a communist sort of, especially in its early years, it had a communist leaning because of its founder, Harry Hay, and the whole way that the organization was structured. And so Doorleg and a couple of right of center guys break away from the Mattachine Society fairly early on, and they form this alternate organization called One Inc. that is critical to the development of homophile politics in the 1950s, of just creating a homophile community, and to the extent that there was visibility. And he's really bringing these sort of libertarian notions into that organization and sees them as consistent with what he's doing and building an organization for gay freedom.
Yeah. Tell us about the Mattachine Society in general. People haven't really understood this. It was an early attempt to create some sort of political organization. And one magazine, it became a magazine, was right. A crucial journal. In other words, that it was delivered in brown paper, right? But it was a really pioneering and ballsy magazine.
Absolutely. So One Magazine was founded shortly after the organization was founded, early 1950s. It was an incredibly brave thing to do, to create a gay magazine and to send it out through the U.S. Postal Service, because this is the height of the Cold War, the height of the Lavender Scare. The entire federal government's apparatus is being directed to surveilling and harassing, criminalizing gay persons, and law enforcement is deeply engaged in doing that. Even the post office is. I mean, this was one of the things that was so astonishing for me to learn as I really went into this history, that I knew certainly the federal government, the State Department, all that stuff, and the Lavender Scare, but the post office itself was being directed to root out anyone they suspected of homosexuality based on the materials they were receiving in the mail, or even if they noticed that if a particular man wrote a lot of letters to other men, they would start tracking their mail because they thought, well, why is this guy writing so many letters to other guys? And then they would start tracking those other guys' mail. So it was a big deal to make this magazine, to print it and to publish it and to distribute it through the U.S. Postal Service. And in fact, the U.S. Postal Service constantly shut it down, and it ultimately went to the Supreme Court.
Yes. What were the politics of one? Did it have a politics, or was it really about creating a community of homosexuals who could feel some connection to each other?
I would say it had like a lowercase p politics, in the sense that by its own existence, it was political, right? But certainly not partisan. Mostly it was about community connection, really creating a visible identity of the homosexual in the 1950s. I mean, we take that as, I think, as a given, right? That someone is gay. That's really being an idea that's formed in this time period. And so both Mattachine and One, really, they see themselves as educational organizations, that we are where you come to like realize you're not alone, that there are other people like you. And here are resources you can read from history, from medicine, from psychology, from theology that help you understand yourself as a homosexual, and that you can connect with others and form community. But obviously there's a politics to that as well, because in doing so, there's a sense of like, okay, well, what does it mean to be a community? What does it mean to be an identity? They're not using that word, but I think they're grappling with these notions. And Dora Legge is someone who begins to argue that there needs to be a homosexual bill of rights. And he wants these to be really, I mean, basic assertions of just individual freedom, that we exist as a person, that we should not be discriminated against because of who we love. You know, this is stuff that from 2024 looks like small potatoes, but was considered radical. And he believed what he was doing was really, again, conservative and libertarian, in the sense that it was predicated on individual rights.
Well, since the government was itself the main force of oppression,
exactly,
in the country, inevitably resisting that kind of government would lead you into a somewhat anti-government position, at least in a skeptical of government. So you had this, you've always had this long-standing libertarian element, this individual rights element to the gay rights movement that, of course, was strongest then in the 50s, about to be eclipsed by another force. But nonetheless, it is important, for people to understand that as this was emerging, there was a very strong center-right libertarian presence in the emerging homophile movement.
Yeah, and again, the powers with which the federal government and local and state authorities directed towards harassing, surveilling, criminalizing gay persons is astounding to really grapple with and to know. And in that history, in that moment, it makes a ton of sense that a lot of persons were like, our pathway towards freedom is one in which the government is constrained. Its powers are pulled back. It's limited. The law enforcement has limits to its power, that the federal government will stay out of our business, that it won't direct, it won't continue to build up an apparatus that's geared towards finding out who we are and ruining our lives.
The other person that comes to mind when you talk about Dora Legge is Frank Kameny, another really center-right sort of principled. These people are, I mean, one of the criticisms I have of the book is that you talk about them as established white men as if that is a criticism of them. But in fact, of course, it took a certain amount, more balls in a way, to jeopardize your entire life, your entire career, your standing in society, that kind to then come out and to do these things and to insist, as Frank did, that gay is good. And not only that, but I'm an American and I work for the government and there's no reason, I'm an astronomer, that's what I do. Are you firing me because I'm gay? This doesn't make any sense at all. And Frank then goes on to file a suit, just as One magazine goes on to pursue its right to the First Amendment freedom of expression. And why did you then say, well, well, of course, it's problematic. These are white men. Isn't it a good thing that they were white men?
Well, I'm not sure I say it's problematic that they're white men, although I do grapple with what the whiteness and the maleness means for them, especially once we're talking about the sort of organization that developed in the late 70s, early 80s. I think the overwhelmingly white male nature of those log cabin clubs that are organizing in the late 70s, early 80s, it shapes their politics. And I think about that, what that means for a whole host of issues. But I think
those politics are dictated by their sex and their race?
No, not at all. But I think that we can understand particular decisions they made or didn't make about the sorts of issues they took up. I think their race and their gender may have bearing on some of those decisions.
I will get to that later, because it's my main criticism.
I think most of these early guys that we're talking about, and honestly, for the bulk of the folks I'm talking about, like I really do hope I communicated through this book a sense of the bravery that they showed in doing this, especially in these early decades. It was a big deal for them to come out in whatever form that meant. And coming out looked a lot different in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s than it does in the ways that we think about it today. They took huge, huge personal risk and suffered a lot for that. And I think that's one of the things I really wanted to show. And I hope it's clear in the book.
It's not clear. For my reading of it, it wasn't clear. These people were all kind of suspect in the book and treated as such. But then their obvious achievements and stuff is treated fairly. But the shadow of their race and sex is held over them in this book the way that it's held over lots of gay conservatives for reasons that obviously they can't help. They're born men, born white. So let's talk about another character, Marvin Liebman, another really fascinating person. I also knew a little bit because I got to know him in the 80s a little bit when I was in DC. Intellectually, this is what's interesting about Liebman. There's a real force. I mean, there were some major intellects. I think, well, Whittaker Chambers, who doesn't appear in this book at all.
Yeah.
Whittaker Chambers, an incredibly important figure in the anti-communist movement, was a gay man, openly gay man on the right. Roy Cohn, who also doesn't appear in the book, was a right-wing gay man. Why do they not appear in the book?
Well, first of all, let me say that I had the great fortune of having a sort of embarrassment of riches here, which is not what I actually expected when I started out writing this book. I mean, I was quite nervous that there wouldn't be enough material to cover here. And in fact, I had the wonderful problem of having to cut so much. And part of that is also deciding when to start the story. When I originally imagined this story, and in fact, when I wrote the book proposal that I sold, the book began in the late 1970s, because that's when the gay Republican organizations, the log cabin clubs, started forming. And that's when, if you look at any short history of this, there's been a couple of chapters, a couple of journal articles, they all begin with the formation of these log cabin clubs in 1977, 1978. And so that's where I thought the story started. And as I got into the research and I realized that the figure of the closeted gay Republican was an ongoing character in the book. And in fact, there's a lot of sort of high profile outings that happened in 1980 and then through the 80s and the 90s, and even, in more recent time, I thought like, okay, well, when I come to each of these moments, I'll sort of do a back history of these persons. But some of them I realized were going to take me back to like the 1940s, the 1950s. And then I thought, well, why don't I start there? Why don't I begin in the era of the closet? But of course, I could have gone even further back. But, at some point, you have to sort of draw a line. So I began, with these guys in the 50s.
And Chambers and Cohn were not part of the movement. They were actually in some ways against the movement. Well, certainly Roy Cohn. Well, Roy Cohn was kind of, I mean, obviously the Laminar Scare and all the rest of it was involved in him. But let's talk about Marvin a little bit. He was a very sweet guy, very funny, witty. He was very close to Bill Buckley. William F. Buckley Jr. They had a very close relationship, which, and this is another fascinating part of the story, is that obviously these relationships also change, because this man is an architect of modern conservatism, Marvin Liebman, in many ways, very close to the National Review, eventually is known to be gay. Bill is fine with it, but then he comes out and then it's just painful. Tell us about Marvin's story a little bit.
Yeah, Marvin Liebman is so important to the history of modern conservatism. He was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. His parents were Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. He very early on, as many folks around him did in this period of history, became a member of the Communist Party and was very active. I think, you know, the consistent thing throughout his life was his devotion to his ideological commitments. And he was at the front lines of the Communist Party USA as a teenager and in his early 20s. And he has a ideological crisis, as many people, especially many Jewish people who are communist, American communist in the 30s and the 40s, when they come to realize what Stalin is doing and what Stalinism is. And he almost immediately, I mean, it's like a conversion moment for him. He breaks from his communist devotions. And for a time, he's just sort of, you know, a person on the left. He's organizing. He's working for a pretty big liberal fundraiser on the left. He learns fundraising skills and direct mail, you know, very early direct mail ideas. But he eventually like starts to move to the right and becomes a very, very close friend of William F. Buckley. In fact, he considered Buckley his best friend. And Buckley actually was his sort of oversaw his eventual conversion to Catholicism. Marvin Liebman joins the Catholic Church. But Liebman is, in a lot of ways, Buckley's right-hand guy in starting. He doesn't help start the National Review, but he gives Buckley a lot of help in those early years, particularly around fundraising. I mean, someone says that the National Review would not have stayed afloat were it not for Marvin Liebman's fundraising prowess in those early years. But he is absolutely one of Buckley's most important players in founding Young Americans for Freedom and the American Conservative Union, these vitally important institutions of modern conservatism. And he's a closeted gay man who's living in New York City for most of his career, has this very like sort of easier way of sort of being out in the places that he wants to be. Like he's going to Fire Island all the time. And then he's also going to sort of Republican cocktails on the Upper East Side. And like, that's the way a lot of people lived in these years. And Buckley, I think, as you say, he knew it before Liebman officially came out. But Liebman officially came out to Buckley in a letter in the 1980s that Buckley publishes in the National Review along with his response. And it's a very painful moment, I think, for both of them.
Yeah.
You can see it in the letters. And then Marvin Liebman sort of makes his way. I mean, he sort of, for a while, he has this moment where he's like an out gay Republican and he sort of moves to the left and he doesn't live much longer than that, actually, but hugely important figure. Such a charming, funny person, even from like his papers, you could see that. And certainly the way he conducted himself in public life. And he was a really fascinating person for me to learn more about and write about.
Yeah. When I think of Marvin, for example, I've actually went to the New York Public Library and read one magazine because I was just fascinated by, you know, the erudition, the education, the standards, the way in which gay men thought of themselves as kind of important in the intellectual world and literary world and the artistic world. And they were interested in these topics and they wrote about them. And if you pick up The Advocate or Owl, some other, it's just an unbelievably low rent in comparison to what we once had. It's so strange that in a period of intense repression, we had a kind of incredible energy, intellectual energy and courage in producing a magazine of that. Just that quality is what I was kind of impressed by. And the freedom with which they wrote. They tackled every taboo. They tackled every taboo, the homosexuals. Do we have too much sex? Are we being too femmy? All these things they aired in a really inspirational way for me, anyway. It reminded me of it was an inspiration for my own journalism because I felt like, man, these people could raise difficult topics about the gay world in the 50s. Surely we can do it in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, Liebman actually had a column for The Advocate for a while. If I'm remembering correctly, it was called Conservatively Speaking at first, and then he ended up changing it after a couple of years to Independently Speaking, which sort of spoke to his own political progression in terms of affiliation or identification. But he was writing about all sorts of stuff. And you're right. I mean, I think this is actually a really good and important point that, you know, it's not just his column, but like his column was sort of the vantage point by which I looked at The Advocate more broadly and really recognized that there was a diversity of ideas that were circulating through that publication that I think we probably don't see. I don't know. I haven't looked at The Advocate today. But,
there is absolutely zero political diversity in all of the trans queer groups and the trans queer magazines. Let's talk about two other characters who are not really as fun and as engaging as Marvin. Bob Bauman and Terry Dolan. Now, Terry Dolan, these people mastered political techniques. He was the direct mail guru, right?
Right.
Who revolutionized Republican fundraising. And tell us, and Bob Bauman was a member of Congress, obviously. Tell us a little bit about those two people.
Yeah, so let's start with Bob Bauman. He's also one of Buckley's very close associates in the same period that Buckley is close to Liebman. In the 1960s, Bauman is also helping found the Young Americans for Freedom and American Conservative Union. Bob Bauman grew up in Maryland. He went to Georgetown University, and he was always interested in Republican politics. He had an aunt give him, when he was very young, a book about, I almost said Ronald Reagan, a book about Abraham Lincoln. And he decided that he wanted to go into politics because of Lincoln's story. And so from a very early age, he moved to D.C. before he went to Georgetown, and he was a congressional page for a while. And then he's actually a Knight student at Georgetown, and he runs for the presidency of Georgetown's Young Republicans or College Republicans Club. College Republicans at Georgetown had been like a very country club type organization in the way that like probably wouldn't be surprising for that university in the 1960s. And Bauman was a conservative, and he got together with a couple of other conservatives on campus, including another very important person named Doug Caddy, who is a central figure of modern conservatism, also a gay man. And they organized a bunch of conservative students on campus to help him win the presidency of Georgetown's Republican Club. And it's just part of, I think, it's an early moment in which it shows sort of he's part of this conservative remaking of the Republican Party in the 1960s and 1970s. He runs for Congress from his hometown in Maryland on the Eastern Shore in the early 1970s. By now, he's married to a woman, Carol Dawson, who is also a very important figure in the history of conservative activism. She had worked in Nixon's vice presidential office while she was an undergraduate, and they are devout Catholics. They have four children. They have this sort of perfect image as young political types who are up-and-comers in Washington circles. And of course, once he becomes congressman, all the more so. He was hugely important in the 1970s. He was a parliamentarian expert, so he was allowed to work with, you know, he was sort of always sitting with Republican leaders at their desk, helping them figure out how to maneuver legislation through the House. He was seen as one of the shining stars of the conservative movement. He was on the long list for being Reagan's VP pick in 1980. In fact, Bauman had been a Reagan devotee through the years, had been very much involved in all the efforts through the years to get Reagan the presidential nomination, which he ultimately gets in 1980, the Republican nomination in 1980. And also, he's sleeping with men the whole time that this is going on. And most of those men are sex workers that he's meeting in these really dingy bars in Washington, D.C. And there was a huge police sting happening in Washington, D.C. in the late 1970s because there was a drug trafficking ring that also involved bringing underage minors from around the country into the city. And this had been followed for years by the Washington, D.C. police. And one of the people they bust one of the sex workers. And that sex worker coughs up the name of Bob Bauman, knowing that that would be a useful name for him to give up. And Bauman is arrested in 1980, and right before the 1980 election, and he doesn't win re-election that year, even as he continues to run for his congressional seat.
What happens to him after that?
Well, it's a sort of interesting story.
Hi there. This is not the end of this podcast. In fact, we're only just getting going. If you're a paid subscriber and are hearing this, it means you haven't yet signed up for the full new package to get our podcast in full. No extra charge. Just go to andrewsullivan.substack.com/listen, LISTEN, and make sure your podcast is up to date with the Dishcast. You'll be able to add it to your Dishcast feed and never have this hear this message again and go back to exactly what you've been doing for the last 2 years. And I'd like to thank you, too, for contributing for so long. If you're hearing this message and you haven't yet subscribed and want to listen to the rest of the podcast, then just subscribe. It's very easy. andrewsullivan.substack.com is $50 a year. Great value for money. And you also get with that the entire weekly dish every Friday. Not just my weekly column, but also all the comments and dissents on that column. You also have a full discussion of the previous week's Dishcast. So all those questions you had in your mind can be answered, or you can hear and read readers debating what we talked about, sometimes calling me to account. andrewsullivan.substack.com. Subscribe and get the whole thing. Join the debate. Join the fun. Subscribe.